Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Challenged by the United Nations chief, Ban Ki-moon, to set a new course for climate change, world leader after world leader today made promises of billions of dollars to take better care of planet Earth. President Barack Obama says the U.S. will meet its goal to cut carbon pollution 17% by 2020 compared to the 2005 levels. The one-day summit was designed to lay the groundwork for a new global treaty to tackle climate change in December 2015. But is that enough? Hundreds of thousands of people marched down the streets of New York City on Sunday to get the attention of those world leaders on the issue of climate change. We have Union College Associate Professor Jeff Corbin in the studio with us today to talk about this very important issue of climate change. He's a biologist who specializes in ecosystem and restoration ecology, as well as the integration of economics and conservation policy. He's the author of numerous publications on the topic, and he's written about climate change specifically in New York. We want to know what you think, and two people are already on the phone. That means there are three left open, and they'll be taken in no time, so get going. Give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can just give us a call. You can just email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Well, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Why don't you turn that thing around so you're talking? That's great. Okay, so Jeff, I guess the first question is, I had a student just today who was telling me it's all a bunch of nonsense. You know, can't prove it. We've been through ice ages before. We've been through hot periods before. The scientific community is just, well, full of it.
Yeah, I think that there is a community out there that feels that way. But the fact is that the science community really has reached a consensus that we're clear that human activities are changing the atmosphere in terms of the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere, and that is going to have important consequences for our climate. So that's really the viewpoint of all of the major scientific organizations, from the National Academy of Sciences to the American Geophysicists Union and on and on.
Okay. Jeff, if you don't mind, we'll go right to the phones. They're all ringing.
Sounds
okay.
Great.
We'll go to number one. All right. It's Jesse in Poughkeepsie. Oops. Well, it was Jesse Poughkeepsie, but it isn't anymore. Okay. So let's go to Ed in Lyonsville. Okay, Ed, you're on.
Well, hey, yeah. I've been on a number of those mass marches over the years, and certainly this one was as powerful as any of them. And I was kind of dismayed to hear on WAMC where they said, oh, there were 100,000 people there. There was somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000.
By the way, Ed, let me just correct you. I know correct is a bad and volatile word, but on this very morning on the roundtable, I said 350,000.
Okay, awesome. I stand corrected. Okay. I'm referring to a broadcast on Monday.
Okay.
But anyhow, I was calling about two things, one of them being that climate, I mean, people can be skeptical, and it's reasonable and fair to allow skepticism on almost anything, even something that's pretty well accepted. But where the rubber hits the road is, well, okay, if maybe climate change isn't happening, and maybe we're really going into an ice age, well, then shouldn't we be going all the more for solar and renewable energy and saving the fossil fuels for future generations? And that's where, you know, you find out that in almost every case, the deniers are saying, oh, no, we need to just drill more oil and all of that. So that's where you can tell, you know, the truth from the nonsense.
Okay, Ed, let's give Jeff a chance here. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I'm glad you're active in the marches and those kinds of things. I think what we're seeing with the march on Sunday and lots of other things is a real grassroots movement expressing people's frustration that we don't have top-down control and hoping that they can agitate for some movement from the ground up. As far as,
well, doesn't it make you crazy though to see the politicians who were not doing anything marching with everybody else, you know, in this thing,
wrapping
well,
their arms
like
around?
Like they say, the people lead and the leaders follow.
Well, let's hope.
The other thing I briefly wanted to mention is the role of our state universities. Now, ironically, it's just about a year ago today, September 19th, actually, when Alice Chandler was interviewed on the station, the former president of SUNY New Paltz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was campus chairperson of NYPIRG during those years, and Alice Chandler's main role, as we saw it, was to dismantle an environmental site and an innovative studies program that had a number of courses on renewable energy. And she caused an entire site of student-built solar houses to be bulldozed, ironically, during the Clearwater Revival, Pete Seeger's Clearwater Revival, on June, 19th, I believe it was, or 23rd, 1981. And as recently as 2006, they bulldozed a solar house that was built by the Advanced Solar Design class back during Chandler's day, funded by a grant writing class that got a grant from the Carter administration. I was very dismayed that that whole interview did not even mention that in a whole hour.
Well, I don't know. I did the interview.
I listened to it very carefully.
And I'm a great admirer of hers. And since she's
Her main thing was to dismantle that program.
No, her main thing was to make a great university out of SUNY New Paltz, and I know that because I was there when she did it.
Yeah, but she threw out a lot of wheat with the chaff. For instance, there was no wine tasting course. Ironically, my son just graduated from Cornell where they did have a wine tasting course, but she mentioned that. And that entire episode with the environmental site and the innovative studies department
was completely ignored. Okay,
and no comment allowed on it until now. And even now you're trying to shut me up. So I think you should really look into the role.
I don't want you to shut up. I just want you to stop saying the same thing around again.
All right, but I think you should do a whole study of the corruption involving the state university system. At the time, Chase Manhattan Bank was on the board.
Okay, that's it. Now let's go to Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Hi, this is Mark. I've coordinated local events for 350.org. It seems to me that reasonable people can disagree over whether the hundreds of millions of dollars on denialist propaganda, whether the Koch brothers and others funding it, are deliberately lying or delusional. But reasonable people cannot disagree about the fact that fossil fuel combustion is progressively overheating the planet. The leading scientific academies of all the major industrial countries, the G8 plus 5, have unanimously been saying that we need to dramatically reduce greenhouse emissions for years now. So the question is, what do we do about it? The science indicates that 80% of the reserves that the fossil fuel industry counts on their books as assets cannot be burned without pushing the atmosphere past the point of no return.
Okay, so now, first of all, congratulations on your important work and 360.org.
350.
A wonderful group. Jeff, you want to give an answer to the question?
Yeah, I would just agree. I think that I would put in one more thing. You alluded to this, that there's a lot of debate and discussion that I think would be wonderful to have as a country and as a world about how are we going to deal with this. If you're a libertarian, you might have one view of government regulation and rely on the markets. And if you're a liberal Democrat, you might have a different view on regulations and those kinds of things. Let's have that debate, but only once we begin with the acceptance of the science. So I heartily agree.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. Can I add one more thing?
It has to be fast because we have a break. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. 350 in New York is calling for a 50% reduction in U.S. greenhouse emissions by 2030, which is a moderate goal. The longer we wait, the more it will cost, the more Sandy's and California droughts will face. And Obama has to get off of the all-of-the-above strategy, continue to promote coal export, fracking, and offshore oil, and go all in on renewable energies as fast as possible. The studies such
as Mark, this week
indicate that it would be an economic benefit and create millions of jobs. Thank you.
Boy, what a day this is going to be. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Ladies and gentlemen, we try to give everybody a chance. But be parsimonious with your words. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care. CECAA.com. 10,000 Villages in Stuyvesant Plaza, Albany, featuring fairly traded home decor and gifts handcrafted by artisans around the world. 10,000villages.com for additional store locations. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock and Rhinebeck. Since 1978, a locally owned health food grocer with organic foods for school lunches, vitamins and supplements for fall immunity support. SunflowerNatural.com. And Safe Harbors of the Hudson, Newburgh, presenting Narcissism and the Self-Portrait at the Ann Street Gallery, Contemporary Art by Emerging and Established Artists. Reception this Saturday at 6:30, safeharborsofthehudson.org.
We're back with Professor Jeff Corbin. We're talking climate change. We've got a Lee in Ulster. Okay, Lee, you're on. Welcome back.
Oh, Alan. Aside from my, and I wish we'd do a program about this at some point, bottom line complaint about the growth model of economics being the foundation under which all of this craziness is supported, is anyone or are any of the people involved in this speaking to the fact that we are just so many? And if we do not control the fact that we are so many and becoming so many more, all of this is going to become a moot point at some time in the process.
Professor?
I think that the population size is a very important one. Paul Ehrlich popularized the question back with his population bomb decades ago. I agree with you. I think that it has to be one part of the conversation. I'll just add one more thing that, maybe puts the hook on even those of us who maybe only have one child. And that is, besides the number of us, it's the amount of resources that we use. I suggest a really good thing. You can look and see a New York Times editorial that Jared Diamond wrote called The Power of 32. And he basically, the gist of it is that we in the West, the industrialized countries, are using 32 times the resources as people in the developed world. And so there may be countries that have a lot more people than we do, but really our oversized impact because of how much energy, how much resources we use is critical.
I don't disagree, but I do say every person eats. There's the waters are being fished out. The Monsanto is constantly being given a pass in order to produce more on less acreage. There is a certain phenomenon in, simply in the numbers, but I just don't see how we can ignore it into the indefinite future.
Well, the projections for human population growth actually are leveling off right now, including in, less in this country than in other industrialized countries. But I think that if we all use less, then we actually still do have some room for population growth and be sustainable at the same time.
So I'd love to ask Lee a question. Lee, while you're on it, how do we do it? How would you, if you were emperor, empress, how would you stop the growth?
I think that there's something needs to be spoken to that having an enormous number of children in order to get a couple of kids to adulthood so that you can be supported in your old age is certainly part of the phenomenon in almost every part of the world except here. And that obviously is a function of bringing people's economic situations to a better state so that they don't feel so at risk all the time.
Okay, Lee, thank you for your call. I'm just trying to get to everybody, and believe me, every one of these phones is ringing off the hook. Thanks so much, Lee. Yeah, bye. Okay, let's go to RJ in Schenectady. RJ.
Hi. First of all, I just wanted to congratulate everybody who marched in the march on Sunday. And I wanted to ask that I had read something like in the early 19th century, there was a major volcano eruption that really cooled down the atmosphere for a couple years. And I'm wondering, is that really true, or would a major volcanic eruption like reverse climate change?
Jeffrey?
So there have been cases of that. Some of the larger ones, Krakatau centuries ago, was one that spews a whole lot of ash. It's basically reducing the energy that's coming into the atmosphere, and so it can wind up having a negative effect. I think it's actually farther back than you were thinking, but there were periods that were described as the years without summer. And we more recently have had that with the Pinatubo eruption in the Philippines in, I think, the 1980s. So that does have a short-term effect, though. As the ash winds up settling out of the atmosphere, then that reflective effect that the ash has in the atmosphere winds up going away. So it isn't a long-term consequence. But if we were to have a major eruption, larger than the one that recently that's been in the news recently, then indeed we could have much colder years, but that would probably go away fairly quickly and not absolve us of the problems of the carbon dioxide.
So talk to me about when you said out of the atmosphere. How does it get out of the atmosphere?
Are you referring to the solar energy?
Yeah.
Oh, it's more that it filters back down to Earth.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, very good. RJ, thanks for calling. Always
welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Edward in Lake Katrine. Okay, Edward, you're on.
Thank you. Global climate change, many experts say, is causing the most suffering to the poorest people on Earth. The richest people on Earth who profit from oil and gas and coal exploitation are in large part the blame for global climate change. One hopeful move by the Rockefeller family was to divest, and the World Council of Churches has divested from fossil fuels as well. My clergy colleague and I saw Bill McKibben at SUNY New Paltz last Tuesday. He was on his way down to New York City, and he spoke and he got loud applause when he mentioned that SUNY New Paltz was divesting. And he mentioned the World Council of Churches divesting of fossil fuel industry funds. So wouldn't that be something that would be a hopeful sign in all of this?
I think it would. I admire Bill McKibben. I think that his work in publicizing this and especially rallying college students to his 350.org and to the divestment issue is a really valuable one. And what he does is try to liken it to the effect that the divestment campaigns and against apartheid had.
Exactly.
And I think there's an excellent argument for that. I'm glad to hear that New Paltz has. I wasn't aware of that.
Yep.
I know that not very, in spite of hundreds of colleges across the country that have kind of begun the efforts to agitate for it, very few have actually done it.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly am sympathetic, and I certainly understand the students' interest in having their colleges' endowments do good rather than harm.
Edward, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much.
I guess I'd say one more thing about that. I don't know if Edward's still on the line, but
yes,
there is the counter argument, I think, which is interesting, which is if you could actually have your endowment or your pension fund actively investing in good
That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm investing
right.
in social purpose funds.
And not just simply saying I won't invest in coal industries, but also I will invest in, you know, startup solar companies,
yep.
not just so I can make a buck, but because I think those are good. There's also the argument for having shareholder rights on dirty companies and those kinds
exactly.
of things. So there are arguments on multiple levels, but I think it's all a good conversation to have.
Yep.
Edward, thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, let's go to Ann in West Stockbridge. Ann, you're on.
Hello. I wanted to talk about fracking being one issue, and having heard on the station on the, I forget the show that's in California.
Commonwealth Club.
Yeah, Commonwealth Club, many times from different environmental scientists about how we can't keep extracting fuel, either oil or, you know, approaching the extraction of gas with fracking, that it's just not, we can't do it anymore. It's got to stop. And they're proposing this pipeline through Massachusetts of fracked gas. And I think for a large part because they want to export it, so they want to get it through to the ports. But I've got solar on my house, and there were incentives, federal and state incentives to go solar, and I haven't paid any electric bill since I, for the year that I've lived in my house, and the excess goes back to the grid, but then there's a certain amount of excess after that that goes, gets traded on the market, and I get checks. So I'm using way, I recently got a notice that they're trying, that the National Grid, in my case, is trying to limit how much credit new customers would be able to sell back to the grid, and the trading of the excess after that is gone, and then the federal and state incentives are, I think, going to be ending soon, and they're saying now that they wanted, the National Grid would like to charge customers who have solar for using the grid to get their electric.
Okay, and we get the picture. Jeffrey, over to you.
I guess I'll point on the fracking issue first, because it's certainly an important one here in New York. The natural gas that we're getting via fracking is a fossil fuel. On the other hand, insofar as it does replace coal as an electricity source, then it's a good thing. But also insofar, it's a good thing only if it doesn't prevent us from eventually being able to get to non-carbon resources. Also, we know that there's a lot of danger of release of methane in the course of extracting the natural gas. And if that isn't done carefully, then that short-term benefit of methane, I'm sorry, of the natural gas over coal is a wash. So really, the fracking, is not a clear winner from an environmental standpoint.
Okay.
Plus, the pipe is going to cost a fortune, the pipeline. And if it's temporary, do we want to do that when it's so fraught with danger? I mean, there's so many instances where, you know, it's polluted water, it's not foolproof. And why aren't we going full speed ahead with the solar?
Okay, and I think you made the point. There are five people behind you. I'm just trying to let
talk about the solar?
Oh, it's great. And I'm, you know, I think that the price structures for people to get their own residential solar is amazing right now. I've been looking into it myself, and you can do it without putting any money down at all. You can get a check in terms of one of those incentives. And I think you're absolutely right that the state and federal governments need to maintain those incentives, not only for residential, but also for commercial wind projects and those kinds of things. So you're absolutely right. The more we can build it, the better.
I can tell you, Ann, and Jeff, I can tell you both that I tried very hard to have solar on our house. A guy came and said, okay, but you have to chop down all the trees first. So that's the end of that. Okay,
you can have some trees, though. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Ann.
Let's go to Abigail in Kingston. Abigail, you're on.
Hi, Alan. It's so nice to be in such good company, intelligent company. Anyway, most of what I'm going to say has already been said. I do believe in the innovation of solar, wind. I think that we should look back 100 years at Morphis and population, at least 100 years, and population. And also, as Bush told us at one point, go shopping. I think we should stop shopping.
What do you mean, stop shopping?
I remember Bush said, one thing he said, stop shopping.
Oh, I see. Go to store. Yeah,
that was whenever that was, right? But I remember that. And I think that was very foolish thing to say, and I think that we should look at consuming less, or just look at our ways of how we live individually.
So stop there for a second, because I'm trying to get a lot of people in here. Jeff, so from your vantage point as a guy who studies as a professor, we keep hearing people should conserve more. Is that right?
Oh, conservation is clearly our best technology that we have. It's the cheapest. It could be not getting to your comment about shopping, but if we're talking about energy use, then the best new power plant is one that we don't have to build. But I think you're absolutely right too, just about the resources that we use, the trying to make what we have go further, buy less stuff. I think you're right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Abigail.
Okay, bye.
You, of course, are listening to the roundtable. Excuse me, you're not either. Vox Pop and Associate Professor Jeff Corbin in the studio with us to talk about this from Union College. I'm just delighted he could come. Let's go to Charisse in Schenectady. Charisse, you're on.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm in the communications field, so my major concern is with framing. And I have two parts of framing that I'm concerned about. Partially is how we've been looking at skeptics. I feel like it's hard to give them space to admit that they've been wrong all along. That's hard for anybody to do, and especially political figures. And I'm wondering what you think about creating a new framework that would enable people to admit that they have been wrong and change their opinions on climate change.
Okay. Doctor?
So I think that's such an interesting point that I sometimes think in terms of there are three types. There are the ones who have the, in terms of the people who say there's nothing to the climate change issue, they're the ones who are financially stand to be hurt by any change, the Kochs and the Heartlands. And so you can see where they're coming from. And then there are the Ayn Rand sort of, I don't like government, and so I don't want to have the regulations that are going to come with it. But then I think there are a lot of people who, don't want to hear the negative news that is kind of the very scary predictions about what's going to happen. And there's some really interesting social science studies right now about exactly the way you put it, how to frame it, and how scientists should be talking about this. And the threatening words that we use are, not getting through. It's useful in terms of the academic discourse, but it perhaps isn't a persuasive one. Naomi Oreskes has written some very good books about this kind of climate communication. So it's a very interesting issue.
So how do you? I ask both of you because it's very interesting to me. How do you get them to? How do you frame something? You're the expert, Charisse. Tell us how you would frame it to get people to come around.
Well, I think it's important to make an open discussion on not just people's opinions, but more like people being able to contribute to ideas on solutions. So I know there's kind of this movement now for corporations to input and collaborate with environmental groups. And I think there's space there for people to maybe come part of the way and say that they support it because of economics, because it's an economically sound to support environmental issues. I think finding ways, places where there's middle ground is the key to framing. You have to focus on those things that people can agree on.
Okay, Charisse, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very
much.
Thank
you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
1-800-348-2551. We've got a Timothy in Scotia. Okay, Timothy.
Hello, Alan.
We got about 3 minutes for this call. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll be very short. I'm gradually recovering from a severe case of almost knee-jerk right-wing pneumonia. I don't want to come down with a case of left-wing knee-jerk bronchitis. I'm trying to stay the radical moderate. They talk about the progressives saying the science is being settled. That's a right-wing complaint. And I do hear a lot of that on, quote, liberal radio, the science is settled. I'm wondering whose science, because I remember 30 years ago, I'm old enough, atmospheric particulate, particularly carbon pollution, along with depleted ozone, was supposed to be something that would cause us to have an ice age within 10 years, which should have arrived about 1980, because that's supposed to be the driving mechanism between every 10 to 15,000 year arrival of ice ages. Then I suppose it would be volcanic activity. But this was accepted science then. Is there any broad-based scientific willingness to accept that maybe we are in a mostly natural cycle, but that human activity has greatly worsened this cycle?
Okay, Tim. Tim, I think we got that. Let's go to Jeff.
So, absolutely, that is one of the main alternative hypotheses that geophysicists have looked at to try to understand whether the rise in temperatures is part of a natural cycle. Could it be due to our orbit? Could it be due to volcanic activity? And I can tell you in that very clearly that scientists have found that it is the human activities that is pushing us towards the warmer climate.
Okay, so now I'm certainly in that camp. However, to get to Timothy's point, what about those times in the past where the scientific community has been wrong?
We are wrong. I guess that to his point about that, in the 1970s, scientists were saying we were about to cool. That's actually not the truth. That actually there was lots of research going on at the time saying that we were warming. Science is open to finding new explanations for patterns. If somebody is able to now come up with an explanation that winds up overturning this, scientists will be open to it, but it has to go through the normal scientific process.
Tim, I wish we had more time. We do not. Thank you so much for your contribution. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. We have no free phones.
Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Winslow Homer, The Nature and Rhythm of Life, through January 4th, 2015, arkellmuseum.org. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. collegestreetmotors.com. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. And River Valley Market, Northampton, Massachusetts. A food co-op featuring fresh local foods, a deli department with made-to-order sandwiches, a soup and salad bar, and a bakery. RiverValleyMarket.coop.
Oh, here we are back. We're delighted you're all with us. The phones, have not stopped for the entire time, and I know why. With us today is Union College Associate Professor Jeff Corbin, and he is a guy who has studied all of this stuff, knows a great deal about it, and I think is clearly very reasonable. Let us go quickly now, because our problem is that we don't have that much time. So let's make this the lightning round, folks. Ask the question and get off. Okay, here we go. David in Albany, go ahead.
I want to state a quandary, but also the fact that most of the callers that are calling in dealing with the fact that the ultimate issue really is consumption and the numbers of people on the planet now. But as far as power sources, the fact that all of the natural gas being produced in this country is bringing down the cost of energy so low now that nuclear power can't compete with it. And we see now, after 30 years of fighting to shut down Yankee Vernon, they're closing the two new nukes that were under construction in Georgia that Obama was using our tax dollars to build are now being shut down. And what do people think out there as far as having benzene in their water, which I'm not an expert, but probably can be dealt with an RO system under their sink, or having a meltdown where we have to leave the eastern seaboard for 500,000 years. Now, I think this all draws back to the fact that there's always the NIMBYs or whatever. There are people that don't like wind in some certain areas, and the fact that we don't produce any of this stuff clean, you know, the nano materials that are going to be used for solar, the epoxies, the aluminum for solar. The fact that the ultimate system of politics that have to deal with economies, that we probably don't need any new energy sources at all. We just need efficiency and conservation, which, oops, doesn't make any money. But anyway, to get back to the nuclear natural gas issue, what do you feel about that? And I'll get off the line.
Well, there have been some environmental organizations that have really angered some of their members by coming out in favor of nuclear power. It certainly goes against what many of them were built on. And from a purely carbon perspective, it's better than some fossil fuels over the entire lifetime of the nuclear power plant that's built. But when you look at the risks, when you look at what do you do with the waste, It's a broader issue than just the carbon. I don't have an answer. And, you know, I change with the wind, as it were, in terms of my opinion as my worry about climate change versus my worry about a Fukushima come into my head.
Yeah. Let's go to Don in Scotia. Don, you're on.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to comment about the role of the media in perpetuating this notion that there's some legitimate debate to be had about climate change. And this the basic problem being that science has spoken. They've spoken long ago on this. The science, the basic science of climate change is well established, yet we still hear this sort of point-counterpoint on the cable news media that leads people to those who aren't in the know or don't have the inclination to dig into this to think that, you know, really it's a wash. You know, that we don't really know what's happening. And,
okay, Don, very professorially put, and let's get to Jeff and let him answer.
Well put, Don. I think that's absolutely true, this point, counterpoint. Gee, if we've got one person on one side and another person on the other side, it must be that it's 50-50 is really the fault of the people booking the shows. So I thank Alan for my empty seat next to me.
Don, thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. Okay, let's go to Stephanie in Beacon. Okay, Stephanie, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is really simple. As an environmentally conscientious person, I get really frustrated when I try to do the right thing and I find that there's no place for it, or it's too difficult, or I've been doing something and then I realize that it's not helping. For example, recycling glass, then you come to find out colored glass doesn't get recycled because we don't have the plants to process it. What do you suggest we do as individuals to try to make ourselves more responsible and in these situations where the infrastructure doesn't allow it or the infrastructure isn't there?
Boy, that's a hard one. My main work with recycling has been through my college, where I've had a cadre of really committed students who have worked to try to do what we can to try to make Union be, you know, really a nationwide leader in its efforts on recycling and composting and those kinds of things. You know, the trade-off between, on the one hand, make it easy for the public so that people will put all of their things into one bin, versus therefore having a pretty low-grade product because it isn't separated according to the color of the glass or according to the type of paper and those kinds of things, is a trade-off. And you're absolutely right. It's tough. I think one thing I'd suggest, maybe a lot of listeners aren't aware of, but, you know, there are, I mentioned composting, and a lot of institutions are doing that, including colleges and universities, but there's residential composting here in the Capital District in a lot of neighborhoods. So look up Empire Zero. That's a way you can reduce your own, at least what's going to the landfill that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephanie. Okay. And let us go to Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry, you're on.
Yes. Hi, Alan. Hi, Jeff. I think one of the biggest obstacles we have for this is that the Western mentality nowadays is for promoting progress and moving into the 21st century. And generally, that always involves more technology. Is the thinking that more technology is always better. And other than the technology to develop better sources of alternative energy, generally, I think more technology always requires more energy. And also the idea that manual labor jobs are less desirable than white-collar jobs. A lot of white-collar jobs, many of them require a lot of energy. So we've got this mentality here that I think is really working against this problem. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly true. When we have our phones in our pocket that have all kinds of heavy metals in them and the like, we're really using a lot of resources and things that when they go into the landfill are going to poison the water. You're absolutely right.
HDTV TVs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, appreciate
thank you.
It.
Bye.
Okay, let's go to Bruce in Kingston. Bruce, you're on.
Yeah, I was listening yesterday to the round table, and Rosemary Armeo made a very interesting comment about how important words are and how things are named or misnamed. I don't remember the context, but it reverberated in me because for 9 months now, I wince every time I hear, you know, climate change. Change is too benign a word. you know, there's positive change as well. We need to call it what it is. It's a climate crisis. It's a climate crisis, maybe even a climate catastrophe. So let's call it that. And instead of global warming, let's change the M to an N. We're getting global warnings, and people will begin to react to this. This has to be used on a massive scale. Climate crisis, climate catastrophe, global warning.
Okay, Bruce, I thank you for your instructions. Appreciate it very much.
That's along the lines of the earlier call we had about framing the debate. I think those are all interesting points.
Yeah, right. Okay, we'll go to Carl in Palatine. Okay, Carl, you're on.
Hello, thank you. Thank you both for this excellent discussion. On a macro basis, jumping back to the future, considering the prosaic economic reality, India and China are not even participating, I understand, in the current discussion. They clearly have the major populations in the world. And in Africa, those people are greatly under the economic scale by any comparison to Western Europe or the United States. The major coal producers don't stop their coal production and the carbon fuels at the Pacific Ocean. This, how in the world can we possibly do much when the major polluters and the major under poverty segments in the world.
Okay, Carl,
are only going to grow.
Okay, put a period there, or a question mark, and doctor.
Well, so I'll take the perhaps the unstated perspective of China and India on this one, and that would be, geez, United States, you guys have been putting carbon into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution, and your people use many times more resources on a per capita basis than we do, and so. You first, United States. I think that that's a fair argument. I alluded earlier to the fact that we use 32 times more resources here in the industrialized world than people in the developing world. So, yes, we need India and China to take their contributions, and especially the ones in the future, seriously. But we have done more in order to create the problem than they have.
So, Carl, I think what you're hearing, I suspect what you're hearing, is everybody has to do as much as they can, and then we have to push the other guys to do it. But we have to start at home.
Well,
no
Obama
question,
said he wanted to lead.
Yeah.
Yes, I completely agree with what was just said.
Okay.
However, given the fact that these are the growth areas, and it is hardly likely that they are going to consume and cut back, as has been suggested
well,
earlier.
Well, but Carl, yeah, you know, we get the point. But people have got to be moving along in China when they're walking around with masks over their faces because things have gotten so bad. There's got to be some reaction to that, doesn't there?
100% correct. And there's no question. The problem is the economic reality drives them to grow.
Yeah, okay, Carl, thank you, as always. Okay, let's go to Miriam in New Paltz. Okay, Miriam.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Thank you very much for having this show. Two things on my mind. One of them is that people half a dozen calls ago were referring to the role of the media, and I wanted to ask the expert if he was familiar with the frontline expose of the politics and funding of the denial machine. There's a frontline program you can stream from PBS called Climate of Doubt. That's
yes.
Climate of Doubt on Frontline, and it's very eye-opening. It's
and there's a great book old. Called Merchants of Doubt, same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So it sounds like you're familiar with that, and I'll check out the other resource.
Yeah.
But my question is, I'm very concerned with the presentation of natural gas, particularly frack gas, because it's a more intensive process and has obvious drawbacks that have probably been detailed elsewhere in the call by the callers. The people don't seem to be talking about the inadvertent and inevitable methane releases and how they offset the potential benefits because of the role of methane as
okay,
a greenhouse.
Okay, Miriam, only because I'm not trying to shut you up. It's only that, you know, we're almost out of time. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, what does he think of that? Did you have a comment?
I just said, go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead, Jeff.
You're absolutely right that the benefits of natural gas compared to other forms of electricity generation like coal are only if we don't, if we're very good at capturing the methane, and if the methane in the course of getting the natural gas via fracking is released into the atmosphere, then it's no better than coal.
Okay, thank you, Miriam. Okay, let's go to Jill really quickly. Jill, we're running out of time here. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to find out if what my understanding of the ozone issue was that somebody mentioned earlier. They were saying that back in the 70s, there was all kinds of warnings about the ozone layer and that the scientists were wrong. My understanding is that they were right, except what we did as a society, we did away with things like hydrocarbons and anything that was depleting the ozone, and that the ozone actually is repairing itself.
So,
am I right or am I wrong?
I think that you're more right than the earlier caller. I'll just give the what you're referring to with ozone, and I think you're right that he did mention ozone contributing to warming, which isn't the case. The ozone layer protects us from UV radiation and protects us from skin cancer and that kind of thing.
Right.
Our release of fluorocarbons, which come from our refrigerant that we were using in those days and aerosol cans and those kinds of things, was degrading the ozone layer, especially around the Antarctic. So we had an international treaty back in the day when we did those kinds of things that banned the use of those chlorofluorocarbons and forced industry to come up with alternatives, which they did. Now, the hole has stopped growing, but it has not yet repaired itself. There is still a hole every winter in the Antarctic winter. And if you watch the Australian Tennis Open, which I do each January, then you'll see all the linesmen and ball people are wearing very extensive sun clothing because the risk down in close to Antarctica of sun exposure is so great.
Jill, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to very quickly, Joanne. We only have a couple of seconds for you. Joanne, are you there?
Yeah, I suppose I'll upset a lot of people, but we got to really boil it down to the capitalist system that's dominated by greedy, profit-oriented multinational corporations. We've known about this for 100 years. John, you predicted global warming. I think what we really have to focus is one of the main families that are responsible for all this is the Bush dynasty. And if Jeb Bush becomes president in 2016, like Nader predicts, then we've really got to get out in the streets in the millions.
Joanne, I'm so sorry. I think you've made your central point, but we are out of time. I thank you for your call. Okay. And Kyle, you got one sentence? Because that's all you got time for, Kyle.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Jeff what consequences and or opportunities he sees from novel ecosystems.
Okay. We only got 1 minute here, Jeff.
Novel ecosystems are ones that have a mixture of species in them. We're going to see a lot of changes that happen as a result of climate change, including species migrating. A biology question. I thank you, Kyle.
Thank you, Kyle.
You're very welcome.
Okay. And unfortunately, we have to leave Ed on the phone. We're out of time. I thank everyone who called in today. Jeff Corbin, you are terrific of Union College. They're lucky to have you. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Valley Home Improvement, designing and building kitchens, bathrooms, interiors, and additions throughout the Pioneer Valley. Love your home, valleyhomeimprovement.com, and the Woodstock School of Art with year-round classes and workshops for all levels and scholarship programs for area high school students and adults, woodstockschoolofart.org, and Zen Mountain Monastery outside of Woodstock, New York, presenting Introduction to Zen Training, a weekend retreat focusing on mindfulness and spiritual practice, zmm.mro.org. Goldberg, and WMC's Spotlight on Underwriters this month featuring news about Goldman Tripp Osteopathic Healthcare, WAMC.org. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/VoxPop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy, doing a great job. Your calls were answered by Bruce Herbeck. Boy, was he busy today. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.